Remember that hazing expert, Professor Ricky Jones, from earlier episodes?
I don't think any hazers get up in the morning and say, are we going to go really injure or kill somebody today?
Well, there's something I haven't told you about him. The reason he got interested in studying hazing, specifically among Black youth, is because of his own experience being hazed and then hazing others.
When I was a plebe at the Naval Academy, I couldn't wait to abuse other people. And I did it. I was notorious for it. I hated the place. I was angry and I took it out on the plebes who came behind me.
Jones entered the U.S. Naval Academy at 19 as a plebe, or first year. And the initiation process was intense.
You don't question that stuff. You know, you internalize it and then you become kind of an automaton of abuse. I didn't question it being done to me. And I didn't question doing it to anybody else. I felt like I was doing them a service. This is toughening you up.
Later, Jones enrolled at Morehouse College, where he pledged Kappa Alpha Psi, a historically Black fraternity. He wouldn't tell me much about the hazing rituals there, but he did reveal this.
I prided myself on never beating people, but I wasn't willing to let go of the process itself.
But Jones's perspective on hazing changed after a random encounter in the early 90s. He was out with a friend who was wearing a Kappa Alpha Psi t-shirt.
And this older Black woman, she looks at my guy and says, y'all in that Kappa group? And we said, yes, ma'am, we know what was coming, you know. Damn sure didn't think what came was coming. And she said, y'all the ones who killed that boy out in Missouri.
She was talking about 25-year-old Michael Davis. In 1994, Davis was killed while pledging a different chapter of Jones's frat. His brothers beat and kicked him until he collapsed. He was found dead in his bed the next morning. The autopsy found fractured ribs, damage to his internal organs, a bruised and bleeding heart, and spinal hemorrhaging.
And that was like, you know, I was like, well, we didn't kill him, but we were part of an organization whose culture led to his death.
But according to Jones, you couldn't find a lot of remorseful people within the Kappas.
That's what made me start to think for the first time in my life, why do we do what we do? You know, what is this really about? At that point, I hadn't thought about it at all. I mean, I'd been hazed, and admittedly, I had hazed people. But I didn't think about why we did it and what the consequences could be.
Jones dedicated years of his academic career to answering those questions. But what were the consequences in his own life? That's trickier.
Because people say to me, look how close you and your line brothers are. Look how close you are to these dudes that you went through this hazing experience with at the U.S. Naval Academy back in the 80s when y'all were plebes. And y'all are still this close. I would wager that y'all are that close because you suffered together. That's a success.
And Jones says that he's mostly unscathed by what he went through.
You know, I appreciate the experiences. They were great for me. I went on, I got a PhD at 28 years old. I've had a very successful career. I'm good.
Except he still has dreams about being hazed. And they aren't good.
Just had one like 3 weeks ago. The dream is always some variation of me being back at the Naval Academy. But knowing I'm not supposed to be there. People are waking me up, making me go to formations. One dream, I had a conversation with a platoon leader where I'm like, look, I'm not supposed to be here. And he goes, oh, where are you supposed to be, plebe? And I'm like, I'm a college professor. I'm not supposed to be. He's like, yeah, you're a college professor. Get your ass in formation. You know, so it's a terrifying dream, even at 55 years old. Even though I'm okay overall, there's still certainly some deep area of my psyche that's scarred. That's the only explanation for that. That was a traumatic time. And moving on from that was a traumatic time. You know, figuring out what I want to do with my life and everything else. That's the only way to explain that.
Hazing is usually short-lived. It might happen in one day or maybe throughout a semester. But eventually, it's supposed to end. The truth is, the aftermath can linger for a very long time. It can be complicated, messy, and difficult.
That trauma's always there. You can learn to live with it, but you never forget.
I'm Iggy Manda. From Religion of Sports and PRX, this is Roughhousing, the final episode. And it's time to talk about the future, about how we move forward. Stay tuned.
Hey there, my name is Jody Avirgan, and I'm the host of a new podcast from TED called Good Sport. I've learned a ton of life lessons from playing sports, from watching sports, and from covering sports in my career as a journalist. During our first season of Good Sport, we'll look at hotbeds of talent, how a new sport like F1 can break through, how to deal with aging out of playing sports at the highest level, and lots more. Check out Good Sport on Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen.
I wanted to show you something in Rodney's room also.
That's Mary Kim, Rodney's mother. When we first met, she brought me upstairs to Rodney's bedroom to show me something.
Not, not.
It was a typical bedroom outside of the bed being made with a couple dozen baseball bats, which, as a kid, I would have loved to have. But that's not what Mary brought me here to see. She pointed at a fist-sized hole in the closet door.
Maybe 2 weeks after his surgery, I heard this loud bang noise and I ran up here and there it was.
Did you say anything to him about it?
Yes, I did. We talked. I asked him what was wrong and he just broke down. And we sat in the middle of the floor and we cried together. And I told him that I know it's hard, but it's going to get better.
And you never fixed it?
No. A lot of people ask me, why won't you get the door fixed? I don't know. Each time I come in here is going to remind me to fight harder for my child.
To fix a wooden door, you'll probably need some cardboard, insulating foam, filler, sandpaper, and paint. To fix a person's trauma, it'll take more than visiting a hardware store.
I used to always ask myself, why me? Why me? Why me?
That's Rodney again, when I first met him back in 2021.
I've accepted that it was me. So what, it was me. And I try and use it as a positive because I wouldn't be who I am today if it wasn't for that situation. But I'm not going to rule out the fact that I could have been a better individual had that not happened. I could have been in a better situation.
Rodney got jumped in 2018. And when I spoke to him 3 years later, I was struck then by how angry he was. Not because he was angry. It was just something in the way he communicated with me. Once he opened up, there was nothing stopping his pain and his violent thoughts from pouring out.
I just don't feel like I could really get over it until I beat the living shit out of somebody that was a part of this situation. I don't care because they didn't care about me.
Rodney told me about this one time he saw an old Davidson teammate on his college campus earlier that year.
When I seen him, I had to double take just to make sure I knew who it was. And at the time, I had my baseball bats with me. But I've just been thinking since then, what could have happened had I just took that bat, broke his legs? Because I still, to this day, have that anger built up in me, and I have yet to be able to let it out.
His violent impulses weren't only for those who hurt him, though. His mother told me he turned them towards himself, too. She didn't learn about it until Rodney was under oath in court.
We were in deposition, and Rodney was on the stand. I can't remember the question, but I remember him saying that he tried to commit suicide when I was at work, and I remember that day. I had that motherly intuition. I remember coming home and his best friend, Jamarcus, was here with him. I remember walking in the den, asking him how was his day. And then he was very short-tempered. He didn't want me to ask him any questions. Come to find out, that was the particular day he tried to hang himself with the sheet from my stairs. And Jamarcus talked him out of it.
These curses hurt. These curses linger. These curses are big. Like, they are big enough. They're life-changing. Now I have a darker side to me. Now I'm depressed a lot of times. I'm suicidal. I'm homicidal. I'm going to have to deal with this shit for the rest of my life. Now, I'm going to need some kind of closure to really take a deep breath and let it go.
Even though I've gone through hazing, a much less abusive form of it, I didn't come out of it with scars. I feel the way Ricky Jones does for the most part. I'm good. But after I first met Rodney that day and learned about how much he was struggling, I wanted to find someone who understands what he's going through, someone who was violently hazed and managed to work through the trauma. What was their path? How did they do it? I reached out to a lot of people, adults who were hazed 10, 20 years ago. No one wanted to talk. Some said they appreciated what I was doing, but the answer was still no. They had put their past behind them and didn't want to revisit it. But then, I found Bob Meeker. Meeker grew up in Goldsboro, North Carolina. Back in 2000, during his freshman year, he joined the wrestling team at Rosewood High School.
And my dad wrestled through, you know, high school and college. And so that was I was like, yeah, I can do this. And for the most part, I was able to kind of hold my own.
What does kind of hold my own mean?
Yeah, I won some, I lost some.
But Meeker was small even for lightweights.
But I mean, I'd always been the scrawny kid and 4 foot, 10, 95 pounds.
And soon after he joined the team, he became an easy target for the older guys at practice.
The next thing you know, you're just pinned out flat, shirt singlets ripped all up, and pretty much everybody around you is just wailing on you. Call them pink bellies. It's just, you know, their hands open, slapping your belly till it turns red. And then, you know, time goes on, it gets worse. And then stomach's purple. You know, a month later, they roll you over on your back because your stomach's still purple and your chest purple. Then they're just beating on your back and your back's purple.
How did it make you feel in the moment?
Helpless. Can't get away from that. 2-3 kids holding you down, another kid wailing on you. I mean, it's you either fight and make it worse, you submit. And that's what it pretty much had to turn into, was whenever it started, you just give up.
How long did this go for? Like, was this every day?
2-3 times a week.
Jeez. He thought about quitting, but his 14-year-old self never let that be an option.
First year in high school, meeting all these people, I didn't want to be that, you know, that quitter.
He also didn't want to disappoint his father.
Dad was a bull. People didn't mess with him. My dad was a 3-sport athlete, rugby player, boxer, football, went to the Air Force Academy. His flight name was Hulk. Let's put it that way. He was never afraid to back down, and he was never really the person that people wanted to pick on. It's in my head, like, I've got to be tough. Got to be tough for dad. And you feel it's your fault for being a victim. At some point, you just break.
The breaking point came in January 2001. He rode his bike to school, went to class, and then took his place on the practice mat. Meeker says he doesn't really remember what happened next, as if he blacked out.
You know, what I remember is the stories I've been told through sparring practice. And I remember just getting just viciously slammed into the mat. They started on me, and they said I just freaked out and ran to my gym bag. And they said I grabbed a Leatherman out of my bag.
A Leatherman is sort of like a Swiss Army knife on steroids.
They said I pulled out the knife and just started pointing at people. Soon as I had that thing in my hands, I mean, that was tackled to the ground.
Meeker was taken to the principal's office.
That was when my parents found out. I kept it from them the whole time.
How did they react?
In the moment, I just remember them saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I mean, that's what you tell your kids. Doesn't matter what your kids have done. You tell them it's going to be okay.
In every story in this series, the Kims, the Oscar Winkles, the Preevies, the main victim had a difficult time opening up and telling somebody what was going on. And it makes sense. They're teenagers. They don't want to rock the boat. They could be scared of retaliation or being embarrassed even more than they already were. But there's a whole other thing that gets forgotten sometimes. People like Bob Meeker and Rodney, they're not the only victims from their hazing incidents. When it comes to the family, everyone gets hit by a stray. Parents might have trouble differentiating the signs between teenage angst and actual trauma. It's not something anyone teaches parents how to spot. And they might blame themselves.
And I remember them feeling bad because, I mean, signs were there. You know, coming home, just getting ice packs, going upstairs, just isolating away. Not wanting to talk about how practice was. Or I think they felt bad because they didn't pry. I didn't blame anybody. I wasn't angry at anybody for not being there because I know if I needed to talk to mom and dad, I could have. I just didn't. You know, I didn't want to seem weak or seem like I was quitting or be a disappointment.
Did you ever talk to him specifically about the pressure of trying to be tough for him?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he told me I was being stupid because I didn't have to be tough for him.
Rosewood High School expelled Meeker after he pulled the knife on his teammates. As he got older, Meeker took it upon himself to make sure no one could ever make him feel as helpless as he did on that wrestling team. He got stronger, and as nature would have it, he got taller. He became a college cheerleader, a bodybuilder, and a bouncer.
You know, you just keep on getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's like, am I a big guy now? Like, do people look at me and they're like, oh, I'm not going to mess with that guy? I actually had a long talk with my other friend last week about being in the bars and being the protector, and you don't want this to happen to other people because it happened to me. And in a weird way, it was me telling myself I can be in control.
Like Rodney, Meeker has had unexpected encounters with his past as a hazing victim. And sometimes he has seen red. Like one time when he was working at a bar.
This kid walked in, I checked his ID, and I froze. He didn't recognize me, but it was one of the kids from the wrestling team. And my friend came up. He was like, you want to go beat him up? And I'm like, no. He goes, you want me to go beat him up? I'm like, no. Is that going to make me feel better? It's something that you would think will make you feel better, but life's too short to stay angry. Staying angry, it's unhealthy. The only time I ever, I guess I'd say lost my temper, or blew a fuse was that day. I vowed never again. Walking away is harder than fighting. I think I was more upset with myself for letting that happen because I'd never been an aggressive or violent person. I mean, and that was not a good thing. Therapists and psychologists say if you back a dog into a corner, at some point they run out of somewhere to back up, and then they're gonna fight to get out of the corner. And the more you hold in, the more you build up, the more you keep to yourself, and the more you just let things happen without talking or finding help. You make your corner smaller. You know, the more people you can talk to, the corner gets bigger and you can eventually walk away from a situation.
Meeker has now spent over two decades reflecting and talking about the events and consequences of being hazed. He's a husband and a father. Time and distance and maybe some of those new muscles have given him more perspective on his hazing.
You have to eventually forgive. You can't forget. You can forgive somebody for doing something, but you never forget it. I've gone through Facebook and LinkedIn and stuff and looked up everybody I can, just go through that yearbook and be like, oh, that person. And most of them seem like they work good jobs, responsible jobs, have, you know, beautiful families and seem like they're great parents. A bad kid can still be a good adult if they're, you know, corrected and learn better.
Things can change. People can heal. But Rodney hasn't had 20 years to deal with what happened to him. He's still coping with the injuries. And unlike Meeker, Rodney's hazing got immortalized on social media for all to tweet about. When I first talked to the Kims in 2021, it was clear that for them, closure, if that was even possible, was a long way off. But after spending more than a year on this podcast, I wondered, how is Rodney doing now? That's after the break. A little more than a year after I visited Rodney and his family in Mobile, I traveled back to Alabama. I wanted to see if Rodney was progressing since our first conversation. I noticed a few things right away. Rodney's now 19, grew a little bit of a mustache, and seemed to be an inch or two taller. He also seemed more at ease, like he was determined to get control over his life.
Just becoming more focused on what I can do with my future and trying not to focus too much on the past, even though a lot of things from the past can weed its way up every now and then. It's not like I wake up every day and I see something on the news about me like I used to. I mean, it can come back up, but I've gotten to that point, I'm either numb to it or I'm more focused on what I can do now.
But some days are harder than others, like the day a federal judge dismissed his lawsuit.
I was with my friends. We were supposed to go out to the movies and skating rink. That ruined my whole night because I was at the point I was ready to fight. So I went home, let off some steam on the punching bag, went upstairs, got on my phone, watched YouTube, went to sleep.
Last time we spoke, you brought up this idea of closure a couple times. And I just wanted to know at this point, have you made that progress towards closure, or is that still one of your goals that you're working at?
To hell with closure. No need for closure. Closure is killing them.
What do you mean by that?
Closure is killing them. That's it. I mean, closure would be, you know, getting the case done, whatnot, but no amount of money is going to make up for what they did and what I was ready to do. Closure would be killing them, so fuck closure.
Why do you connect closure with violence?
In this particular situation, violence felt like it would have been the best answer. But it wasn't. I'm so diligent on putting that behind me and moving forward. Because let's be honest, an emotional man is a very dangerous one. I mean, that's not a threat that I'm making, but I could have easily just done it the old-fashioned way or done it the usual black man way. I could have let my emotions get the best of me. With time, I'm sure it'll get better, but I'm still young. I'm still dumb. My brain isn't even done developing, so I'm pretty sure as an older man, I'd be able to look back on it and see the blessings it gave me. But as of right now, it's just something I'm not really ready to focus on.
Oh, my Lord. That those were the words of a 19-year-old.
That's Ricky Jones again. I asked him to listen to some of Rodney's tape because as someone who has gone through hazing himself and studied and written about it, and as a black man in America, I was hoping he could help me dissect Rodney's words.
He was very conscious of options, conscious of history, and he was conscious of race, too. You know, how black men are looked at. Like, you know, our first option is to be violent, or black people overall, that our first option is to be violent. And the reality of it is, if you look at the overall historical arc of this country, black people have suffered a hell of a lot more violence than we've inflicted. And we have to figure out how to live with it. But he was conscious of that. For this young man to say, you know, at 19 years old, he's like, later for closure, I got to move on. I can't let this eat me up. So he's making a very conscious choice so he can get on with his life and allow other people to live. That's pretty profound. So good for that young brother, 19 years old, understanding the situation that he's in and how he must move forward if he's going to have a productive life and not be buried in a prison cell somewhere.
I started this whole roughhousing journey wanting to shed a light on a phenomenon that we allow to happen in our schools to our kids. I just wanted to understand why. And through that journey, a lot of people have shared their most painful moments, their lowest points, their scariest thoughts. As a journalist, I'm just trying to do my job. But as the person who asked them to revisit these memories, it's made me feel guilty at times. It's made me wish that I could give them something back. At least some kind of answer or tip from my research on how to find a path forward. But it's not that easy. I asked Jones, can these people find closure?
Neat closure? I don't think that exists. Being able to move on and lead a decent and productive life, yeah. You know, my grandmother died in 2009, the woman who raised me. My mother had me at 15 years old. I had to meet my father until I was 35. My grandmother was my everything. Talked to the woman every day. She was the center of my universe. And she died. I thought I would die. But I kept living. Am I still bothered by that loss? Yeah. But it's much easier now. It's something that I can handle. I remember the good times better. There is no quick fix to any traumatic situation, hazing included. You know, loss of a loved one, loss of a relationship, psychological damage, physical damage from a hazing situation. So do what you got to do to keep yourself alive. And I say that very seriously and very carefully. Do what you got to do for yourself or people around you that have experienced something traumatic to keep yourself and them alive so that they can kind of cross the Rubicon and get to a happier space. So I go Matthew McConaughey on that. Just keep living. You know, just keep living. Everything gets better the farther away you get from it.
My mom's favorite saying is live on. I'm at the age now too, I understand there's nothing I can do about that. So kick off that pawn off the chessboard. Keep moving my king ahead.
Not many people would ever be as candid as Rodney has been with me. And I think that means something. Maybe there is something to talking. Bob Meeker stressed several times throughout our conversation that talking, being open and honest about what he's going through, it's helped him heal and avoid the sudden snaps of anger that got him expelled more than 20 years ago.
I think part of opening yourself up is telling people your worst, you know, the lowest you've been. Because, you know, if you feel like you can't let your friends or your family know who you are and what you've been through, sometimes you feel like you're guarded. And then you're always looking over your shoulder. You're like, God, I hope nobody ever Googles my name. You have to talk to people. You cast a wide net. You can't get through something with a small circle because it's too much weight for one person.
Tracy Stopford, from the last episode, thinks so too. Since Jordan's death, she's changed the way she parents her youngest son.
I do a mental health check with him, and I call it that. So I've learned my lesson not to be embarrassed as a parent and ask the hard questions and poke your kids, especially, you know, I poke him all the time to tell me how he's doing, and not just to say, fine. No, fine won't do it for me. You know better.
And even though it had to be hard to talk about the loss of her son, Tracy said she also found it helpful.
Talking to you helps me feel better that I'm not doing anything, if that makes sense. Like, I feel purposeful, even though it's a small thing. And it keeps him in my heart more alive. It's so important to talk about the hard things.
In a funny way, I feel like this interview is almost my closure.
That's Sabrina Oshkar-Winkles from episode 4.
There's closure in the sense where you can talk about it and you can understand it and you can be really comfortable with everything you did and be proud of all the steps you've taken. But there's never going to be that closure in the sense where it's just going to disappear from your life and you know you're never going to think about it or talk about it again.
We're living in a time where what's okay and what isn't, at work, in relationships, at school, is being questioned and redefined. And maybe finding the path forward requires lots of brutal honesty and vulnerable conversations about where we've been and where we want to go. Even when it's difficult, even when it's uncomfortable.
You know, maybe one kid in some school somewhere is on a team, and maybe he's doing this to other people. You hope maybe he goes, this isn't good. And he speaks up and he stops it. And that's worth it. You know, you always want to leave the world better than you found it.
In the first episode of this show, we heard that the Kim family talks about two Rodneys. The fun, light up a room Rodney from before, and the quiet, isolated Rodney after. When I first spoke with him one-on-one, I knew what that second Rodney looked like. I knew what he sounded like. As much as I didn't want to define him by what happened in the Davidson locker room, that was the only Rodney I ever met. That is, until the family moved us all to the backyard later that same night. The stars were out, a fire was lit, Michael Jackson's Billie Jean was playing on some speakers, and Rodney, for the amusement of his family, friends, and me, put on a show.
Yeah, I haven't seen this in a minute. It's been a couple years since he did this.
No, go around. Come on.
Yeah, it's a...
Come on,
come on, dog.
Rodney, he can dance. I ain't gonna lie to you. He can dance.
Like, he's bad. He's the Usher and the Michael Jackson all in one. James Brown, all of that.
I can vouch for dude. He can dance. That night, seeing him enjoy himself with his family and friends, I felt like I was catching a glimpse of that younger Rodney before the hazing, before the trauma. But now, at the end of this journey, what I hope I was seeing was a new Rodney altogether. Someone who knows what it means to struggle, but also can enjoy the moments in between. Someone who knows that his past dreams and past pain don't have to define his future. Someone who moonwalks, but is trying to take steps forward. That won't be easy, and he may not get there anytime soon. But he's on his way. This episode was written and reported by me, Iggy Manda. Jessica Popovac is our senior producer. Our lead producer is Nina Ernest. Siona Petros and Carly Peruccio are our associate producers, with support from Megan Coyle. Michael Garofalo is our editor. Tommy Bazarian from PRX Productions is our engineer. Fact-checking done by Jane Ackerman and Kim Frieda. Our executive producers are Gautam Chopra, Amit Sankaran, and Adam Schlossman. Special thanks to Jacques Norpo, Tim Rowan, Kevin Sullivan, Sarah McRory, Chelsea Marotta, Joe Levin, and all the families, victims, coaches, experts, friends who took the time to tell me their story. Roughhousing is a production of Religion of Sports and PRX. This is the last episode of the season. So if you made it this far, just gotta let you know how much we appreciate you. This show took a lot of hours, a lot of cups of coffee, and a lot of dedicated care from the team. So genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening and supporting the show.